Right, so we'll start the final session. We started 5 minutes late, so we'll go on 5 minutes after the end, if everyone's all right with that. And as we'll stick to the same format as we've had before. Jeff will give a brief summary, a brief introduction, followed by Victor, who will give a, I'm sure, not brief response.
She's so on the
And then if I could shut him up, we might get Jeff to speak again. And then maybe everyone else will have a chance to say something.
Well, I apologize for the lateness of my paper. I hope some of you have had a chance to read it, because I think neither one of us is actually going to summarize it. Let me begin by quotation from Patrick's paper, because there's serendipitously a nice statement of the problem to which my paper is a response in here. Patrick says, "Once war has broken out, the international realm lacks effective institutions to determine facts of culpability. For each participant soldier, the preeminently salient and effective institution is the government of his or her state, which has ordered him or her into battle. Only those soldiers whose culpability is settled independently of these institutional considerations, that is, those who are themselves aware that their cause is unjust, will fail to enjoy a personal defensive privilege." So the defensive privilege rests on absence of relevant moral knowledge for Patrick and Toby. Now, my paper makes a proposal for an institution to determine not really the facts of culpability, but one possible ground of culpability, namely whether the war in which a person is fighting is unjust. Now, this is important on my view because I think the morality of war hinges on, or I should say the morality of participation in war hinges on jus ad bellum facts. In most cases, with a few exceptions, my view is that it is morally wrong to fight in an unjust war, at least a war that lacks a just cause. Now, many people have pointed out, of course, that the practical implementation of this revisionist understanding of the morality of war is subject to an important constraint. It's an epistemic constraint. That is, how can soldiers know or be expected to know whether or not their war is morally just or unjust? And many people have argued for the traditional doctrine of the moral equality of soldiers by appealing to this fact of epistemic limitation. They say, for example, we have to have a division of moral labor. The governments or the populations decide whether or not it's permissible to go to war. That's properly their sphere to determine whether the people of a particular country are going to go to war, and then the job of combatants is just to fulfill the will of the people or to obey the orders of the properly authorized government. And some people suppose that the epistemic constraints that give rise to the necessity of the division of moral labor actually provide a permission or even a justification for people to fight in a war that is in fact unjust. Other people think that this provides an excusing condition. But even if it provides only an excusing condition, this helps to perpetuate unjust wars, because if people believe either that they are permitted to fight if their war turns out to be unjust, or at least if they'll be excused morally if their war turns out to be unjust, they will lack an incentive to try to determine whether the war is just or unjust, and if they see that it is in fact unjust, refuse to fight in it. So there's a practical aim at the heart of my paper, which is to try to reduce the epistemic excusing conditions that would be available to people who fight in unjust wars. And of course, I think that, as I note in the paper, that if one minimizes or reduces the epistemic excusing conditions, then some of the other types of excusing condition will be reduced in significance as well. So what I'm proposing is that there is a need, and a really important need, to provide people, and citizens as well, but combatants or soldiers in particular, with reliable epistemic guidance about whether or not wars in which they are commanded to fight are just. I'm uncertain how to provide this epistemic guidance. I make a proposal in the paper. I'm much less confident about the details of the proposal than I am in the need for some kind of institutions to fulfill this function. So I've tried to do a bit of the work in thinking about this, but confidently expect that people will be able to point out all sorts of defects in the proposal that I've made. I've welcomed those because I take this to be a very serious idea, and if I'm making mistakes in thinking about how to give practical shape to this idea, then I need to know about that. So I'm sure I'm making mistakes, and I'd be happy to have those. I mean, very happy to have those pointed out to me, because this is a case in which I think it's really important to try to get it right, to do the very best that one can. What I suggest we need in the first instance is a new and better understanding of the morality of jus ad bellum. The history of thought about the just war is not terribly good on this. War was very different in the day of the classical just war theorists. As international society evolved and changed, the focus in the theory of the just war and in legal thinking about the law of nations shifted very much away from jus ad bellum towards jus in bello, because there was greater scope for practical regulation of the conduct of war than there was for the prevention of war. So for a good while, jus ad bellum kind of dropped out of the picture, and this is true in international law as well as in the theory of the just war. So around the time of the 19th century, especially in the late 19th century, the resort to war was regarded as a sovereign right of states, something they could do for basically any reason in international law. So this is an area that has been neglected, the understanding of jus ad bellum. So I think, and of course in 20th century international law of war, you see there's very, very little there. In the UN Charter, there's this, two legitimate instances or occasions for the resort to war in the event of an actual armed attack, and if the Security Council authorizes a state to go to war when it perceives a threat to international peace and security. Not a very subtle, nuanced, complicated, sophisticated understanding of jus ad bellum. There's a bit more in other areas of international law apart from statutory international law, but not much. So we need, I think, a newer, richer, deeper understanding of the morality of jus ad bellum. We need then to be able to translate a richer understanding of the morality of jus ad bellum into some kind of code that can be understood by the agents of states as a guide to practice. And then after we get such a code, we need some kind of body to interpret it in particular instances and apply it to particular wars, to facilitate our understanding of whether a particular war is just or unjust, permissible or impermissible. Now, I suggested two possibilities in the paper. We could have an unofficial code with no particular standing. We could have some kind of interpretive body, again, with no particular official status. That something along those lines could conceivably be enough. Certainly be better than nothing. But I suggested, you know, ideally, the code would be a new law of jus ad bellum, a new understanding of the law of jus ad bellum, a new legal instrument. And ideally, we could have some kind of official court whose mandate was to interpret and, in some sense, administer that body of law, though in my view, not for enforcement purposes, but for purely epistemic purposes. I suggested in the paper the possibility of a special chamber within the ICJ that would deliver advisory opinions that wouldn't be binding on states. No idea whether that suggestion is in any way realistic. There's a question, you know, Simon O'Connor raised with me earlier, and that is why a court? Why would one want a court? And one of the reasons is that courts can have a particular kind of epistemic function. That is, if you look at what ordinary criminal courts do, a large part of what they're doing is epistemic. They're trying to figure out whether someone is guilty or innocent. And we have devised procedures for criminal courts that are actually pretty good at determining whether a particular person is guilty or innocent of an offense. Certainly more reliable epistemically than in any individual's private judgment. So that's one reason for trying to produce something like a court, that is, a body that would be constrained in its reasoning by conformity with a particular code, that it would itself have a certain epistemic authority, and where the operations of this body, its deliberative procedures, would also be constrained in a certain way. You'd have deliberative procedures that were marked out in advance as being reliable for generating authoritative answers to the questions submitted to it. So that's, you know, one reason for looking at a court as a kind of model for deliberation about these issues. There's also just the need for authority quite generally, so that people will pay attention to the judgments of this body. And I am assuming that, you know, if judgments have force of law, that gives them a kind of authority in people's minds that they wouldn't otherwise have. I suggested to Simon during the break, it just occurred to me while we were talking, that might be better if it might be more effective if one could have the jus ad bellum code within a holy book, you know, some sort of holy scripture, and instead of a court you could have a kind of priestly caste that would be charged with the task of interpreting the understanding of the morality of war in the particular holy book. And then the judgments of the body wouldn't have the force of law, rather they'd have the force of the Word of God. And that would be even better if we could convince everybody that this was the Word of God and it was actually epistemically reliable. But second best would be some kind of court whose judgments would have something like the authority of law. about matters of jus ad bellum, where the court could actually pronounce while a war was in progress, and that would then provide combatants in the war on both sides with reasonably reliable guidance about whether what they were doing was wrong or not wrong. Certainly, in most cases, more reliable than their own private judgment, and I think more reliable from an impartial point of view than what they were being told by their own state, because as we all know, states do just lie to their soldiers and their populations, particularly when they want to fight wars. They're very good at concocting all kinds of lies and so on. And I mean, we have a history of this even in democracies. I mean, we know it happens in non-democratic societies, but it's amazing how easily people are lied to and accept the lies, even in democracies, even when people know they have a history of being lied to over and over and over again, they still believe the next round of lies. Was that for me?
Okay.
Time, ladies and gentlemen, time. So I'm finished, and now I welcome Victor's ludicrous remarks on.
I'm never going to live this down. So first, I just want to say thanks so much to Seth for organising such a fantastic conference. I'm the last speaker because no one gets a chance to speak after me. So this would be a good opportunity to do it. I never knew that talking about mass killing could be so much fun. So. Let me reconstruct the first part of Jeff's argument and then address two issues in it. Okay, so many people endorse the permissibility of participation, which is the thesis which holds that it's morally justifiable to kill in the course of war when one's political leaders acting on behalf of the state has declared the war on the state of those killed to be just. They believe there's a duty of obedience to fight in accordance with such a declaration. And Jeff rejects this view, rightly. We can call it the stupid view that no one should hold. Even though this is true, we should be cautious about blaming and punishing those who fight on the unjust side of a war, for the reason that people are often excused and may act even in a praiseworthy manner. By being courageous. I bracket this and say this is the fishy idea that people can be courageous for doing horrible things. I'm not sure about that. I think courage might depend on goodness, but let's leave that aside. So even though we shouldn't blame or punish these people because they might be excused or they might even be praiseworthy in some ways, we should hold that permissibility of participation is false. Furthermore, endorsement of the permissibility of participation causes more people to fight for the unjust side in a war, Jeff claims, and endorsement of the permissibility of participation does not cause people to fight on the just side of the war, or if it does, we could cause them to fight on the just side of the war in other ways were people to reject the permissibility of participation. So it seems to follow that it would be better if, obviously it would be better if fewer people fought on the unjust side of a war, were there to be few effects on people fighting on just sides of war. And therefore it would be better if people in general were not to endorse the permissibility of participation, because that would have more effects on people who are fighting on the unjust side than on the just side, so it would be good if people didn't believe in the permissibility of participation. So the practical effects of rejection, general rejection of the permissibility of participation, would be enhanced if people were to make accurate and confident judgments about whether the war declared by their state was just. And what's required then is authoritative guidance about whether the war is just. So it would be nice if we had someone to tell us which wars were just and which wars were unjust. So let's think about how we can get good guidance about this. Let's set up a body of really smart people who know a lot about war, and they can think about it a lot, and then they can form some judgments about what the conditions are for just war. Wouldn't that be good? And then they can make declarations about particular wars and say, well, this one's all right and this one's dodgy, so don't go into that one. And then when we had rejection of the permissibility of participation, then people would be less likely to participate on the unjust side, and they might still participate on the just side, and so the just would win, and that would be good. Right? So that all sounds nice. That's the argument. And Jeff's given you an outline of some of the practical considerations that might determine how we should set up these courts, so I'm not going to go into that. Okay, so I don't want to obviously doubt Jeff's rejection of the permissibility of participation, which is obviously right. But I want to address two questions. One is the question preliminary to the setup of this court, which is the question about whether it would be better if people generally rejected the permissibility of participation. That's obviously something which is independent of its truth, right? It might be really nice if lots of people hold the stupid view, because maybe that would make things turn out better. So I want to try and give some reasons why we might think that it's better when people endorse the stupid view, even though it's stupid. And then the second question is whether we think that Jeff's court could provide the kind of authoritative guidance on jus ad bellum considerations that we need. Okay, so would it be better if people generally rejected the permissibility of participation? Well, widespread rejection of the permissibility of participation would help to dissuade the morally motivated from participating in wars that they believe or suspect to be unjust. But it might not always be decisive, because sometimes there would be prudential considerations for them to go into these unjust wars which override their moral motivations. Assuming, though, that some people sometimes act on their moral judgments, which might be true, then it's plausible that at least some people aren't going to join in on the unjust side. Rejection of the permissibility of participation will result in a person not fighting in a war under two conditions. The person believes that the unjust war is unjust, and prudential considerations don't motivate the person more profoundly than their moral judgments. Okay, so it will sometimes lead a person not to fight in a war that's in fact unjust, but it will sometimes lead a person not to fight in a war that's just, because sometimes they'll make mistakes about the justice of the war. And Jeff tends that it'll tend to have the former effects more often than the latter. So I want to examine the extent to which these two conditions are likely to be fulfilled both in democratic and human rights compliant states and states which are non-democratic and less human rights compliant. So we've reason to suspect that citizens of democratic and human rights compliant states are less likely to follow the declarations of their states than citizens of non-democratic and human rights non-compliant states, despite the fact that democratic and human rights compliant states are more likely to form the correct moral judgments than non-democratic and human rights non-compliant states. Why should this be? Well, first, non-democratic and human rights non-compliant states do much more to foster an attitude of compliance among their citizens. Secondly, non-democratic and human rights non-compliant states restrict access to information and a broad range of views that tends to undermine critical attitudes and tend to educate their citizens less effectively. So although non-democratic and human rights non-compliant states will likely make worse judgments than democratic and human rights compliant states, citizens will tend to trust them more. I think that's something which we might at least believe. And furthermore, citizens of non-democratic and human rights non-compliant states will tend to trust international institutions less. And that's because their states will tend to restrict access to information about these institutions and try to undermine their credibility. Hence, rejection of the permissibility of participation will tend to have less effect in non-democratic and human rights non-compliant states than it will have in democratic and human rights compliant states, even if supported by credible international institutions. It will tend not to undermine participation in unjust wars in those states, and those states are more likely to start and participate in unjust wars. And this will also undermine the effectiveness of rejection of the permissibility of participation in preventing unjust wars. Furthermore, the rejection of the permissibility of participation will have less effect in non-democratic and human rights non-compliant states for the reason that those states will tend to provide people with more profound prudential reasons to participate in such wars. They'll use much more draconian measures to punish people who don't go and enjoy the conflict. Some of those measures may even be sufficiently powerful to render participation in an unjust war permissible. In contrast, in democratic and human rights compliant states, rejection of permissibility of participation may have more profound effects, for people in those states are encouraged to have critical attitudes toward the policy of their government and will tend to have greater confidence in their own judgments. Furthermore, as the measures used to punish non-compliance will be less draconian, people are more likely to act on those judgments and not go to war. But whilst the rejection of the permissibility of participation will tend to undermine people's willingness to participate in unjust wars, it will also undermine their willingness to participate in just wars. And that's not only because they'll tend to form mistaken judgments that a just war is unjust, despite institutions telling them otherwise, they've got these critical attitudes, but also because they'll tend to be criticised and condemned for going to war by their fellow citizens, some of whom will say the war's unjust even when it's just. who may also make the mistaken judgments about the permissibility of war despite these institutions which they'll tend not to trust. So this suggests that rejection of the permissibility of participation is likely to weaken the war-making capabilities of democratic and human rights compliant states much more profoundly than it will weaken the war-making capabilities of non-democratic and human rights non-compliant states. And this may well be that the tendency of non-democratic and human rights non-compliant states to perpetrate unjust wars will increase for the reason that they'll feel that they're more confident about not being resisted by these democratic states where all citizens choose not to go to war. 10 minutes more.
No.
5 minutes more. Okay.
No. Ten minutes down, okay.
And given that it's comparative war-making capabilities that matter, then we might think that this is a bad effect. We reduce the overall number of people participating in the wars, but it's the comparative strength that matters in terms of likelihood of winning, and we want the unjust side not to win, right? So this creates one question for Jeff about whether this is going to increase the asymmetry between just states and unjust states in their war-making capabilities. Now I want to talk about the capacities of the court and whether the court, suppose this is false and that we should get people to reject the permissibility of participation, now let's think about how good the court is likely to be. We might have some doubts about the legitimacy of the court, so the court is not going to be sufficiently representative and it's not going to have any kind of democratic kind of authority. We just pick people who we think are good experts rather than try to get representatives of different cultures and so on. That might undermine its legitimacy a bit. I take it the legitimacy might increase its effectiveness. There's some good reasons to try and bolster legitimacy just from a pragmatic point of view. I don't think that these reasons are decisive, though, because, for one thing, Jeff's court's not intended to be binding anyway. And also, even if it were, we might think as long as it improves the situation over what we have at the moment, then that's obviously a really good thing, and a lack of legitimacy isn't fatal to the proposal. The question is whether Jeff's court would have the capacities that he claims for it. And we might think that the tendency of a decision-making body to make judgments depends on two capacities that it might have: the capacity to make good moral judgments, but also its capacities to evaluate a set of facts. And the thought that I have here is that Jeff's court might be really good at developing a set of moral capacities. It's all these really smart people who think about jus ad bellum. Now, of course, there's going to be lots of fighting and disagreement, and Casper and Gerhardt are going to try and fight for the poor, and other people are going to reject that, and so on. There might be lots of fighting out, but let's just suppose that somehow that people kind of get to some sort of consensus, and this does really improve its moral capabilities. I think that's at least plausible. That might be true. But then it has this epistemic problem that it doesn't have very much access to facts about the effects of war and what it's going to do. Right? So we think that whether the war's just is going to depend on lots of facts about things like security and how well the state is likely to do after you've invaded it and whether insurgents are likely to come into the country and all this kind of security stuff. And so I worry that Jeff's court is not going to be very well suited to gathering the kind of information that you need about a decision to go to war. So very often the court's going to think to itself, well, if I knew more about the security situation, I had all these facts, then I'd be able to make a confident judgment about whether the war was just. But I don't know very much about the facts, and so it's going to be really hard. And we see this in national security situations all the time. So when courts in the United Kingdom think about whether detention without trial is justified in human rights cases, they often come to the conclusion that although we have some doubts about whether the security situation is sufficiently bad to justify this, we're going to defer to Parliament, because Parliament just has a lot more facts about this than we do. And it's only under very special situations where the court's willing to say that there's an abuse of human rights here. And those are usually situations where their decision doesn't depend quite so specially on the facts. So the courts tend to be very, very deferential to Parliament when it comes to thinking about security situations where the information is complicated, there's lots and lots of rights that are implicated, and some of the information is secret. Courts just tend to be very deferential. I just think that's a systematic feature of courts. It's very, very hard to get courts not to be like that. You remember that in criminal cases, we go for a conviction. We only get the conviction if you prove beyond reasonable doubt that the person's done it. There's no question of declaring anyone to be innocent in a confident way. We don't say this person's definitely innocent, we just say they're not guilty. Right? We don't have, and then there's a presumption of innocence, so that might create some sort of attitude that we should have towards people once we don't convict them. But we don't really declare anyone to be truly innocent, we just couldn't prove that they were guilty. That's what we really say when we fail to convict a person. But Jeff's court needs to say both that a war's just or that it's unjust. But very often, of course, you're going to say, well, if you don't have enough access to the information to tell whether it's just or not. And so that seems like a worry here. There's going to be very many cases where we just say, where the court's just going to say, we're not sure. Furthermore, you might get the worry that some skeptics about protected constitutionalization of human rights worry about. That some skeptics about human rights think that when you put human rights into court, what they do is they tend to legitimize the actions of their government by declaring what they've done human rights compatible, even though there's good grounds for suspicion that they're not, because courts are not sufficiently confident to say that they're not. And this court might have a similar kind of problem, that it tends to declare some wars as being not clearly unjust because the court's not confident enough, and that gives people grounds to say, well, actually, it's just because the court didn't say that it wasn't, and so it actually might turn out to play this kind of unfortunate legitimating function for wars that many people actually want to resist through political opposition and so on. So let me wrap up there.
Brilliant, thanks very much, Victor. And, well, I've already got... Henry started a sort of stealth war of hand-raising before Victor had opened his mouth, so I've already got 13 people on the list. And it'd be nice if everyone could be as disciplined as Victor was, because with 13 people and 60 minutes, that means an average of roughly 4 minutes a person, so let's stick to that. All right, Henry, take it away.
I'm trying to go fast. I've tried to prepare Jeff for the shock. I like this paper. and I'm sure other people are going to point out ways in which it's utopian, but I take you at your word that you're trying to do something practical, and I want to quickly give a couple of precedents that I think suggest it maybe is not totally hopeless, and then make one constructive suggestion. There have been other sort of imminent blue ribbon panels that have actually had really significant influence on the public discourse. There are a number of examples, but one is the Brundtland Commission, which coined the term and defined the term sustainable development, and now it's just impossible to talk about development without claiming it's sustainable. The commission that produced R2P has clearly had a major impact. It is now an institute connected with the UN and so on, and everybody's talking about R2P. Another example that's actually more like your court, because as Victor points out, you're talking about really judging cases, is Amnesty International. Nobody asked Amnesty International its opinion. It just started saying, you're violating human rights, and by implication, other people aren't. It was so careful and so responsible that it got a lot of credibility. Now there's Human Rights Watch copying it. These haven't ended human rights abuses, but they have a lot of authority and a lot of impact. So it seems to me one crucial strategic question is exactly what question your group would try to answer first. And I think the first thing you probably do agree with, I think you don't want to ask about legality, because I think the lawyers are already locked into a doctrine about basically the UN doctrine, and that's going to probably get the answer you don't want. And in any case, I think what you want to ask is about morality, which wars are moral. And the thought is, start with how to define aggression. Now, I know that you think there are other just causes besides resistance to aggression, but the thing about aggression is the lawyers are interested. The ICC is immobilized until they get a definition of aggression. And so there's a sort of ready market for it. And I think that the humanitarian interventions that it's actually reasonable to back, and the very few preventive wars that it's reasonable to back, can actually be construed as defensive. And so I think a good place to start would be there. If, you know, deep in your heart you want to get other causes advanced, I just think you should save that and start with this. But that this would be a place that you would answer a question that people are asking, what's aggression? And you would still be saying, here's the moral basis for deciding what's aggression. You wouldn't be saying it's legal. But that people would find that useful. And there's some hope, I think, that the sort of people you're talking about could actually make a contribution to that, and people would notice and pay attention to.
Well, I thank you for that. Yeah, I am concerned with morality rather than law, but I'm also concerned with taking a richer understanding of morality and trying to codify it in a way that we can kind of reduce it to a set of rules that could be action guiding, where some of the nuances would have to be left out. And maybe you're right that it would be prudent just to start with aggression, but I have in mind something more ambitious here, where they would really be able to judge, for example, whether an instance of humanitarian intervention, which looks like aggression according to traditional definitions, is actually just war.
You could do that fine. You just say, on the right understanding of aggression,
I wouldn't want to say that, because that looks like it's gerrymandering a concept in order to be able to use the approved term, and I want to call things by their proper names, and aggression is usually one state kind of invading another state and so on. By the way, in August, the ICC committee or whatever did reach agreement on a definition of aggression, so that has actually happened. Do you see Simon in the back there? I think maybe a finger.
Is this a finger?
It is just a
fingers are going to have to be near instantaneous.
Yeah, the definition of aggression is a crime now in the ICC statute. There are issues about when it will become effective in the ICC statute, but there's a criminal definition of aggression now. And just on that point, and it talks a little bit about the last presentation, one thing that struck me, Jeff, was now there is a crime of aggression. And that crime is clearly, as all crimes are, once on the statute books, intended to have a deterrent effect. Is that not really a starting point, rather than looking to a new judicial institution which won't have that type of deterrent effect because it's not got any sanction that the ICC does have? Now, beyond the point that it's individual criminal responsibility at the ICC, but clearly that's aimed at those in power, which is the same people I think you're aiming at.
In a way, not really. That is, in the more of the moral territory international criminal law can cover in a reliable and effective way, the better. But I do see international criminal law speaking mainly to leaders. High-ranking officers and so on, people who, and potential war criminals, and so on, rather than just people who may end up fighting in unjust wars, but fighting by whatever rules are in operation at the time. So I really want something that speaks to the consciences of individual combatants. That's the primary point. I mean, it's good if it speaks to civilian populations as well, and even better if it speaks to political leaders and high-ranking military officers. But the primary audience is individual combatants.
Thank you. Shlomit?
Yeah. It sounds great in theory, but I'm a bit suspicious about the practicality of it. And since you are looking for a practical solution, for one thing, the ICJ already gives advisory decisions, so I don't think it will be unique if it will give another one. But this kind of decision takes time to decide. What you want is at point zero or zero plus hour to allow the soldiers on each side to know whether they should contribute to the war or not. It doesn't happen so quickly. If you're thinking in terms of each state, of state A and state B, will come to the court, will have to present their case. The whole thing is something that will take, if we do it very quickly, in months. At the very least, if not, these kind of things take years sometimes after the fact in court until a decision is being made in terms of compensation and things like that. What you're looking for is something that will come very early. The other thing is things often change. So take the war, the last Iraqi war. So let's say that there was weapons of mass destruction. That would possibly make a difference as to whether the U.S. should have engaged in war or not. So if the U.S. really believed this, and at the beginning the U.S. could produce the evidence they had for the suspicions, and then later on they found out that actually there isn't, right? And then there is a question that comes up, so what? You want them just to clear up now? So now, at which point do you stop it? Can you stop in the middle of a war because things change? Can you then just say to all the American soldiers, okay, no more, the war, now it became clear, the war is unjust, now you all pack, take your tanks, your weapons, and go away, leave the country in whichever solution it is, even if the major attack happened in the first few days, and then the devastation is so severe that they can't just leave because they've destroyed the main powers and the main government institution. It just seems to me like the kind of decision, it's really nice if we could have this. And then how do you...
Can we try and limit the supplementary questions? I think that's two or so there. So.
Okay. There's a little something in the paper about each of those problems. I think I say in the paper that on the issue of time, that there is this kind of dilemma here. There's a trade-off. That is, the longer the deliberation, the more reliable the verdict, but the less effective the judgment can be in limiting the wrongs that are committed. The shorter the term of deliberation, the more effective the judgment can be in limiting the wrongs, but the more likely it is that the judgment is going to be unreliable. So, yeah, I mean, that seems to me unavoidable problem. But again, the question is whether something's better than nothing. And so obviously one would seek some kind of reasonable trade-off between reliability and effectiveness. I also mentioned the problem that the moral character of a war can actually change. So I think that this judgment would have to be revisited in the light of changed circumstances. What was once an unjust war can become a just war, and what was once a just war can become an unjust war. They won't be different wars. They'll, you know, a war that continues beyond the achievement of the just cause can be unjust. It may well be utopian to think that a country might be persuaded by a moral judgment to abandon a war in progress. I don't know of any examples of that, though. I don't know much about military history. Graham was saying he knows, you know, he read about military history as a child and so on. But wouldn't it be wonderful if a political leader could ever have the courage to say, you know, I've just realized this war in which we're fighting is really not morally justified anymore. We should just stop. I mean, I think that's what President Obama should do right now in Afghanistan. It's just hopeless in Afghanistan right now. You know, whatever the merits of the initial invasion, I think some kind of military response to Afghanistan was indeed warranted. But the thing has dragged on now for 10 years. And yet it's politically impossible for a leader to say, there's just no point in this anymore. It's, you know, it's a bad idea. Let's stop.
Okay, thank you. Johan?
Thank you. The existence of this court implies declaration that the war in progress was unjust and illegal. That in progress seems to me to be very interesting and suspect, because in this way it precludes what is the essence of the war. The warring sides accepted the war as decision-making rule primarily because of two things. First, there is no other way to solve the conflict. All other ways has been exhausted. And second, which is crucial, is that they do not want to leave the conflict unsolved. So the war is directed to itself. This is happening before the end of the war. So there is the following question. How it's devised to function? There are two possibilities. Seems to me, first, that it would give its proclamation in some, presumably very bad cases, condemning one side authorizing in a very humanitarian intervention against that side. But there is other possibility to do that on the regular routine like basis, in which case all the wars would be assessed, and the business of the court would be determining which side should win, conferring right to win to once and condemning others to defeat. So it would become a kind of business of issuing licenses to the victory. Issuing licenses to the victory.
Okay. I don't think wars are accurately characterized as two sides having agreed that war is going to be their decision-making procedure. That is, when it's not always the case that there is some pre-existing quarrel. It is just the case sometimes that one side invades the other because it, you know, wants to achieve some aim. And in those cases, it's not true that when the war ends, that leaves the initial problem unresolved. In those cases, for the victim of the unjust attack, the problem is largely resolved by the ending of the war. That's all that it takes. I do think that the problem, what you see as the problem of a court licensing victory by one side or another, is something that we already have. That is, the United Nations can claim that a war is being fought by one side is illegal. The problem there is that nobody thinks of the UN Security Council as having any kind of epistemic authority with respect to the justice or even the legality of war, because they are so heavily it's such a heavily politicized body. It is not a deliberative, an impartial deliberative body.
Why just not forbid wars?
Well, because that's why. Because you don't want to forbid just wars. I mean,
all the wars.
But then what happens when somebody disobeys that and you have an unjust war? Then you don't want to forbid the just war in response to the unjust war.
Good, thank you. Bob?
So, I had a lot to say in anticipation of a lot of people giving just some problems about the epistemic argument, but it appears not to be the sort of thing that survives. I will say that I think that Jeff is taking the right tack at the epistemic argument, but it is often overplayed. The epistemic conditions of the soldier are so utterly fixed that they can't overcome them. And I think the proper question is to ask, what happens when we overcome the epistemic block? The other thing about the epistemic argument is, I think there's actually one out there, pretty strong case to make, that we can't have such an epistemic block. This sort of reasoning, trying to justify why we're doing what we're doing at the ad bellum level, is the sort of thing that soldiers do every day. Regardless of what we think about their access to information, it's what figures in how they reconcile their actions, it's what figures in how they plan their actions. And I think that this is a nice proposal to see how we can maybe at least do better by half in giving us the sort of information we need to make these sorts of decisions. Some things against Victor's arguments.
Try and limit it to a couple, yeah?
Yeah.
It's going to be tough.
I think the idea that the rights-respecting army would be somehow sapped by the removal of the epistemic block is wrong, in that it's at least possible to conceive. It would lead us to a smaller set of wars, so that we wouldn't exhaust ourselves over these long and intractable campaigns. And then the other one is what we're talking about here. If we're a rights-respecting government, and we send soldiers to fight in these things, they need real resources to come back from these sorts of campaigns. without being sort of, not sort of, but shattered and broken. And the problem is that on the other side, moral equality of soldiers really turns out to be cold comfort. And if we take ourselves to be a rights-respecting regime, I think it's a problem we need to figure out, is how we can have soldiers that fight that don't sort of take on these problems. And then I don't have time to lay it out, but I think the right institution for this is the professional armies of liberal democracies.
Do you
need to be?
Thank you very much.
Do you want to come back?
No, I just want to defend myself.
You're giving you a chance.
Yeah. It was like, all I thought was just that it wouldn't tap the army, maybe it wouldn't tap the army that much, but it would tap the army to some extent in human rights respecting democracies, because people would just take a more critical attitude, and some people would decide that the war wasn't just, even if it was in fact just, right? And I take it that that's... I mean, I'm just a general sceptic about what institutions tell me, so I take it that lots of other people are also going to be sceptical, and the more we give up the permissibility of participation, where you just do, it's permissible to just do what your government tells you, lots of people are just going to form a judgment about the war, which, you know, about some just wars, if they're unjust.
Yeah.
And then that's just going to be less true in these other countries where people don't take these critical attitudes so much. So it's just a question of, asymmetry.
Right. I think the point would be that it's an open question as to what's worse for the rights respecting government. Is it a sort of slavish military that just runs and does whatever it's told to do?
Yeah, the thought's
and
just
gets involved.
In some ways, it's better to have a slavish military. So we've got this slavish military that will just do whatever we want, and then we know that when other countries have this deterrence, that when they know that if they're going to attack us, we've got this slavish military, which we can just get to pile in, right? But if they think they're all going to have these critical attitudes, then they're going to think to themselves, well, let's just go and, you know, we can just test the boundaries a bit. We know all these people with critical attitudes are not going to join in. If they've got this suspicion that the war's not going to be just, then they're going to not join in as much. So we can just go test the boundaries, let's invade the Falklands a bit, and, you know, and then all these anti-Thatcher critics are going to say, well, we're not going to participate in the war because we don't think the Falklands War is just. And we don't think the fact that our government's told us to go and fight is a reason to fight. So let's just not fight in that case. I mean, I thought that was at least plausible that might happen.
No,
but the Falklands War might have been justified on deterrence grounds, right?
I love the fact that you're telling professors of philosophy at West Point who train soldiers in ethics.
can I just? Yeah,
of course.
5 seconds on this.
Yeah.
Most of our Israelis have left limits here. But I think of Israel as a counterexample to what you're saying. That is, you find actually more dissent within the IDF than in probably any other military organization, at least that I know of, more kind of active dissent and refusal to participate in certain missions and so on. But nobody thinks that they can just walk over to the IDF.
Dan's hiding. Dan Saxon.
My question has been answered.
Oh, great. That's very honest of you. Patrick Emerson.
Just a few suggestions. For an expert panel type institution, I suggest rather than the ICJ, you're looking at the human rights bodies under the ICCPR and the other human rights treaties. I think they're a better model for non-binding but expert legal decisions.
Okay.
On the issue of the capacity of your court, I think Victor raised the Waldron Keith Ewing type issues. I think there's also RAS issues about the extent to which competent legal authority can issue morally loaded directives. So I think some reference to that literature might bolster the case given the credibility of the institution.
Okay.
I think both in your paper and in Victor's responses, there's a lot of empirical claims which might need justification. And the notion that democracies are less aggressive than non-democracies, like I think it's hugely up to grabs as a fact of history. And in fact, there's good reason to think one important function of a liberal democracy is to mobilise its people the war in a way that other sort of countries can't. And in the issue of whether democracies would respect the judgment of this body, at least the one I come from, Australia, incredible disregard of the international human rights bodies, and where you like waged a campaign, including the UN, against the credibility of those bodies. So there's some empirical claims in your paper that has to be fleshed out. That were just some sorts.
Okay, good. I would have argued with Victor about democracies too, but I didn't get a right of reply, which is fine. I'm not complaining, but I would have said something about that myself.
Good, okay. Cheney?
I think that doing what you're describing, Jeff, would be a great thing to do, so this is not an argument that it's a bad thing to do. But I do see the problem I see in what you're saying is not that it's utopian, but it's sort of halfway utopian. And what I mean by that is that when we first see proposals for international arbitration mechanisms and stuff emerging in the late 19th century, it was based on the notion that the world can get more enlightened because states can get more enlightened. And it seems as if a lot of your argument is we need an enlightened world entity because the states are absolutely hopeless. And it just strikes me that there's kind of a tension there between thinking that there must be something about the institutions of the individual state that's going to stand in the way of letting them make these judgments more accurately, but then setting up a world body, which among other things won't work unless it has the consent of the states to deliver information. And I'm saying that partly because what would you say about someone, and they're not mutually exclusive, who said, why don't we just work from the ground up rather than the top down? The United States Constitution already has features that were meant to achieve just the sorts of things you're saying. The mechanisms for making the decision to go to war was based on the notion that you should have as much discussion as possible, get all the facts out. The notion of a citizen's army was based on the notion that if you jack up the cost of going to war for the average person, they'll take it more seriously whether they wage war. The problem, of course, is that all these things have been forgotten about or thrown away. They were there at the start. And wouldn't it be equally as realistic to say, let's take these civic republican mechanisms, let's make them meaningful in the cities where in the countries where they exist, and let's try and just plant them more and more places. I understand that's a utopian proposal too, but it strikes me as might be equally a viable solution as the one you're proposing.
Well, I'm not sure what to say about that. It certainly seems to me that the constraints on the resort to war in the United States are incredibly feeble and don't actually require conformity with any kind of moral principles. They are feeble institutional constraints that don't guarantee any kind of moral reflection on the resort to war at all, much less imposing any kind of institutional obligation to engage in moral reflection about the resort to war. And they don't. There's no principles there to which legislators or executive members can appeal in trying to determine whether or not it would be permissible to go to war. The question about whether or not the kind of institution I have in mind could work without the consent of states, I think, is an open one. Depends on what form it would take. If it's going to, if it were to take form within some pre-existing legal institutions, if it were to have some official standing within international law, then it would have to be subject to the consent of states, and it may well be that states don't ever really want to be told. I mean, it may be that the costs to powerful states of being told, potentially being told that they're fighting an unjust war, would outweigh for them in a prudential calculation the benefit of their adversaries being told that they were fighting in an unjust war. So you might find at least a cabal of powerful states that would object strenuously to such a court ever existing in international law. Certainly I can't imagine the Bush administration ever signing on to anything like this. That may be true of other powerful states as well, in which case the idea of getting something along these lines implemented in international law is pretty hopeless. So one would then have to go outside international law and pursue the kind of alternatives that, that Henry was suggesting, something you know, that would have the kind of authority and credibility of Amnesty International or the ICRC or something like that, which wouldn't have any kind of particular legal authority behind its judgments.
Can I just come in very quickly? Mm-hmm. So there's this worry also that either, say, the Americans are going to try and influence the court or change its composition, or alternatively that the court will try and appease the Americans because they need to get them on board. So we know this happens in international criminal law, right? That they, you know, appease the Americans and not try and hold them accountable for the things they've done, because it's really important to get them on board so the long-term future of the institution survives. You've got all these kinds of problems about tinkering as well, which I think you need to address.
Yeah, so part of what I wanted to say in response to Cheney is I would, you know, the ideal here is to, in a way, to have maximum distance from states. That's the whole point. And therefore, states are going to be unlikely to be happy about such a thing. But you don't, you certainly, this thing is not going to work if it's subject to, you know, if it's going to crumble in the face of pressures from powerful states and so on. And it's just not going to work. So the whole idea is independence from states. This is something that, this is to counteract the actions of states when they're behaving badly, which they often do, and they may not like that.
Helen.
This is also about the idea that wars have just and unjust phases, but more sort of a worry more about the kind of how that might impact on the practical aspect of your aim for. I mean, in some sense, these judgments are always going to be retrospective, right? I mean, you know, we get the evidence in and we have the ruling, which is going to be based on, well, the evidence, say, a month ago suggested this war was just, let's say. But that's not necessarily going to tell soldiers anything about whether they should be fighting here and now. So I wonder whether once you kind of open the door to the idea that the judgments are always in some sense conditional, right? They might be revised, they might be, there might be another rule later on which says actually no, that the war's now unjust. That's going to perhaps significantly undermine the ability of the court to give advice that soldiers can rely on.
Yeah, I agree that there are problems in the area you're gesturing towards. It's not the problem is not just that the character of a war may change over time, but also that even at a given time there may be unjust dimensions to a war and some just dimensions to a war. That is, it may well be the case that a campaign that some soldiers are fighting in is one in which it's permissible to fight, so that if a body of the sort that I'm envisaging were going to be were to do its job in a way that aligned its judgments to the greatest possible degree with the judgments of morality, the unit of analysis would not be a war, but might be something like, you know, a mission or a campaign or an aim. That might be it. You know, something like, you know, the achievement of a certain aim. If the court could identify a certain aim, they could say this aim is unjust to the extent that what soldiers are doing supports the achievement of this aim, it's wrongful. On the other hand, if the aim is thus and such, and if what they're doing reasonably supports that aim, then it may not be. Something like that. I mean, I haven't worked out. You know, this is really complex. I mean, as you know, the morality of war is terribly complex. If at least some of us are right, maybe it's relatively simple if some other people are right. But I think that we don't understand the morality of war terribly well yet. I mean, there's a lot more to be done. This study is in its infancy, and the more complex the morality is, then the more complex the legal judgments may have to be, or the judgments of whatever kind of body this would be. And, you know, what can I say? It's not my fault. we should do the best we can. You know, whatever that is, we should be striving to provide people with reliable guidance so that they can make decisions about matters of extreme importance with the kind of maximal reliability. And I think that, you know, a point that I haven't made, and I probably don't make in the paper, is that I think this is something this is a point that I think Cheney would make. I think I'm speaking for Cheney here. We owe it to the combatants themselves to provide them with this kind of guidance. It's not just for the sake of the victims of unjust wars, but it's also if we're going to be asking people or commanding people to go out and kill other people on our behalf, we owe it to them to ensure that they've got the kind of moral tools that they need to be able to determine whether what we're demanding that they do for us is actually something that they're permitted to do.
Thank you. As you've noticed, we're not taking fingers now. So, Massimo.
Okay, just a quick one. You've been mostly talking about cases where the war is already taking place, or is about to take place,
right,
and then the court declares whether the war is just, and then people should act accordingly.
Yeah.
Could the court also issue an opinion when no war is taking place?
Yeah.
You know, but there is a justification for the war, and so the court should encourage someone to intervene and to fight the war. Of course, it sounds tricky, but...
Well, I have in mind, I actually wasn't expecting your final sentence or two there. I mean, I do think that there are occasions in which we can foresee a war coming. Like, I think everybody knew that the war, could see that the war in Iraq was coming. The Bush people were making noises about it before they became Bush people. Back in the early 1990s, they were, you know, and this went on through the 1990s. And we noticed that all these vociferous advocates of war against Iraq found positions in the Bush administration and so on and so forth. So one knew for a long time that this was probably going to happen. And the United States was building its case in the media prior to going to war. In those conditions, I think the court could pronounce in advance. So far, we see no case, no just cause for intervention. Whether it could make judgments of the other sort, there is a case for war against such and such a country. I don't know, I haven't considered that. See Simon shaking his head back there.
Cases like Rwanda, maybe, or cases where
That was the case I had in mind,
yeah,
when you mentioned this, and I wanted to say I just don't know whether this is an appropriate function of the kind of body that I have in mind to say, hey, anybody wants to go fight a war over here, that got our permission. But I do think it would have been nice if somebody had said one should go help the Tutsi in Rwanda.
Okay, Yanina.
So I wonder what the essence of this sort of overwhelming intuition of everyone is that this is unrealistic or utopian. And I think you said it yourself, is that what you need is the maximum possible distance to states or to statehood. But at the same time, you ground this in international law, which obviously is constructed around states and statehood. So let me just make like two points for why you should drop the law, sort of with Henry on that point, and make this about morality ultimately. One is the fact that you can't get around states and international law. Basically, what you would want is a system that we don't have, because international law is formulated in a way that you can argue both sides, and that's deliberate. That's even for something as basic as what does it mean to have an inherent right to self-defense. I mean, there are at least three different theories about it, and the ICJ is the case in point, which hardly ever comes to like a one opinion and mostly has significant amounts of judges on both sides, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't want a different kind of international law. Well, you say that, but you know, it's like, as long as we have states, it's unlikely that you'll get it. And the other part is about the mandating system of international organizations, and there's a variety of differences, but for the kinds of for authorities with epistemic purposes, like human rights commissions or fact-finding commissions, you have opt-ins, right? That either the state opts in with the treaty or on an ad hoc basis for different cases. And I mean, just the fate of these organizations tells you that the states don't wish to have that kind of authority telling them what they are doing. So that is sort of, I think, the essence of why this is unrealistic. And the other point, that it doesn't have to do primarily with states, but you want to address the individual, and you want to tell the individual ultimately what you're doing is immoral, right? That's
mm-hmm.
the sort of the pull that your argument has. But why don't you create like a cognitive tension if you then tell them what you're doing is illegal, but we're not going to punish you for it, because under international law there's no way. wouldn't it be much more likely to actually reach the individual if you told them what you're doing is immoral and that's why you shouldn't be doing it? If you're ultimately under, don't have any legal sanctions at hand anyway. I think that was my point. So basically just, like, the point of the law. You know, like, and one friend here, do you know about this, we as teachers of international law? I mean, that comes most closely to what you're actually describing, a bunch of international law teachers in the UK saying, before the war actually started, the Iraq war is illegal. They had all these problems about, you could argue the other side and the individual didn't care and whatever, but I think if they had been a bunch of moral philosophers having said, this war is unjust, they might
everyone would listen to them.
Who comes closer to the divine authority, a bunch of lawyers or a bunch of philosophers?
People think we're a joke, you realise that.
There's probably some variations in culture here. If you want to find in the United States the most derided class of individuals, it's probably philosophers. I mean, we're maximally distant from divine authority in the United States. Philosophers are taken more seriously in Britain than they are in the United States.
In Oxford.
So actually, I do think that lawyers have a whole lot more authority with ordinary people than philosophers do. I've been taking notes on what you've said. I take all of this as helpful advice, and I don't really have anything to say in response, except to the last point about what's the point of telling somebody that what he's doing is illegal, but we're not going to punish him for it. I mean, I do think that there are areas of the law in which that's precisely what we say to people, in some of those areas of law, we say to them, we're not going to punish you, but we're going to force you to do certain things. I mean, you pay compensation or whatever. We're not judging that you're wrong. But it seems to me that legal institutions do have a certain kind of moral authority. And to say to somebody, we've modeled our law on morality, and what you're doing is illegal, but there are these contingent pragmatic reasons why we're not criminalizing it. And that can be quite explicit. We can say, what you're doing in fighting in an unjust war is actually illegal. Jus ad bellum applies to you as an individual. It doesn't make your action criminal, but it makes it illegal. And the law is based on moral norms. That can, I think, be quite effective.
Can I just on the credibility point? There's a tension that the court's going to face between distancing itself from the states from states to avoid being corrupt, but aligning itself with states in order to improve its credibility. People trust their states, they think we're going to improve our credibility if we can also get the consent of states or get states to think that we're an authoritative body. So I don't think the court's going to be in such a pure position as you want it to be. It's inevitably going to have this tension.
Okay.
James.
Okay. I'm a bit puzzled why you've rejected the Security Council completely out of hand. My reasoning is that, well, in the paper you say that you're concerned with improving this current situation rather than striving for the complete ideal. Now, I take on board what you say about this, kind of your ideal court, and yeah, that would clearly be better than the Security Council. However, I think the Security Council would at least be better than the current situation we face. So there's a number of reasons why we might think that. So for one, it's going to be having the Security Council make rulings on which wars are just and unjust. Well, it's going to likely to be efficacious in terms of states are more likely to listen, combatants are more likely to listen, the rulings are less likely to be discredited by states. Now, we also think about Security Council, well, yeah, of course, it's often said it's full of partiality, but it does have a degree of impartiality. There is kind of some sense which is slightly impartial. And,
it doesn't matter which alien wins the war in the case of two.
But I mean, it's also reliability. Well, how many? Yeah, okay. I'll be very, very brief. How many unjust wars has the Security Council actually authorised? Well, I can't really recall that many unjust wars in Security Council so far. So I think there's, I'm a bit unsure why you've rejected it as a kind of an improvement on the current situation.
Well, the main reason is that the representatives to the Security Council are agents of states. They're representatives of states. They have no particular credibility or authority as impartial thinkers about law and so on. And remember, the function of the court is to say not only which wars are unjust, but also which wars are just. And one of the problems with the Security Council is that it will often veto. One of the permanent members will, if it were to have this function, would veto justified wars, let's say, of humanitarian intervention against itself or against an ally or whatever. I mean, suppose the United States advertised the war in Iraq as a humanitarian intervention in the late stages when the claims about weapons of mass destruction and preventive war and so on were wearing a bit thin. It resorted to a campaign to say that this was, you know, Iraqi freedom and so on and so forth. So it presented it as a humanitarian intervention. If somebody had said in the Security Council, well, you know, this isn't a humanitarian intervention, this is an unjust war, then the United States would have just vetoed that. And maybe you have in mind an understanding of a reformed Security Council where permanent members don't exercise a veto. So I just don't know. But as it is now, I think it's pretty hopeless.
Okay.
Okay. So think about actual scenario. Germany and Russia invade Poland. The body that you have implemented decrees that both wars are the war of both Germany and Russia is unjust. So the Russian army starts having revolts, some people deserting, and so on and so on. Then Germany invades Russia. Now the Russian army at this point is revolting, deserted, and so on, so it's far less able to withstand the justified war, which is decreed as justified by that body as just. So it's far less able to withstand that war at that moment. Just one point about the IDF that you mentioned earlier. The reason that the IDF is very, very permissive on questions of disobedience and refusal is that the amount of refusal is, the level of refusal, which is much higher than most armies, is still so low that it never affected the IDF's ability to carry out its missions. And what I think you have in mind is a body which will bring exactly that effect. It will prevent unjust war by making soldiers on the unjust side unwilling to participate.
So. Well, I think a lot depends on what happens to Soviet soldiers who refuse to fight in Poland. If they just wander off back to their homes in Siberia and the Red Army kind of dissolves as a result of the ruling, then your scenario is very worrisome. On the other hand, if states were to respond to the possibility that it was now an international institution that might judge their war to be unjust with these, you know, with the possible consequence that some combatants or soldiers would refuse to fight, then they could adjust the nature of their institution in advance to take account of this and perhaps have some provisions for conscientious objection that would allow their soldiers to remain soldiers and poised and ready to fight the Nazis if they were refusing to fight in Poland. I mean, I see what you're saying, but I don't see it as a kind of insuperable objection to the idea. I mean, I do take it that it would be an appropriate response to the existence of a body of the sort that I'm envisaging here for states then to respond by making more kind of liberal or generous provisions for conscientious objection, retaining people within the military and providing exemptions from certain missions and so on.
Thank you. David?
Yes,
I mean, I think this is terrific and actually really, really important. So I really commend you for the paper.
Thank you.
A couple of things. You said at the beginning that what we need to start off with is a kind of thoroughgoing reconstruction of your sub-balance. Now, clearly that will have to happen, but I wonder whether that's something that needs to happen right at the outset, because one of the things about the reconstructed your sub-balance is it's going to depend on the development of the authority, right? Because one of the reasons why ad bellum is so crude is because the authority doesn't exist.
Right.
If this authoritative body gets stronger, you know, the stronger the authority, the more sophisticated the ad bellum can be. So I think at the very least it'll have to kind of happen in parallel processes. And I wonder actually whether at the outset it shouldn't just simply use the existing international law. I'm not sure about that, but. The second thing was on consent. So you say rightly, I think, that one source of legitimacy for this body would be consent. But then you talk about that consent in terms of consent of states, which I don't think you really need. I mean, it seems to me, in the way you're envisaging it, the consent you really want to go after is individuals. I mean, you talk about soldiers. I think that's one important group here. But the great thing about technology is actually you can cut the state out completely. You can use the internet. You can literally go. You know, you can set up a website. Ask soldiers to sign up, make a commitment, say they'll only field in an operation that's been endorsed by this body, right? You can talk to them directly. You could even go to the armies, right? Say, okay, US Army, you're having problems recruiting people. Well, how about we together do a recruiting drive whereby your new recruits will have a specific contract that says they only will be used in operations that are legitimized by this authority, right? So there's an upside for the Army. And maybe they have different rights to the regular Army. Now, that may not fly, but it's a conversation that you could have. Thirdly, questions about uncertainty, right? So you say...
Chris Case has got a finger there. You should probably take it.
You say... you kind of look at questions of uncertainty. You say, well, even in cases of uncertainty, the court would be giving a kind of guidance. And you say that in cases of uncertainty, soldiers might regard themselves as being permitted to take part. Now, I'm not sure that is the right conclusion to draw. And I wonder even whether the operational rules of the court shouldn't be something like this. It would only make two kinds of determination. It would either determine that a war was clearly justified, or it would determine that it was unable to reach that conclusion that it was clearly justified. So that would have a number of consequences.
Can we limit it to one or two of those consequences?
It would stop the court feeling it was in a position that it always had to give a decision in very ambiguous circumstances, which would kind of, I think, would problematize and undermine the legitimacy of those decisions. Right? So it would only make a decision where the situation was really clear. It would also provide an incentive for states to come to the court, right? Because there's an upside for them. They can get the tick assessment. Or the worst is that they'll get, you know, we couldn't tell. And then what I would want to do is say to the soldiers, you know, as a matter of morality, unless the court says tick, you shouldn't be going.
Okay, that's excellent. Thank you very much for all that. If you had a chance to drop me an email to help me get all of it. Comment I have is just that your two possible determinations would make it the case that this court would be operating on the reverse presumption from criminal courts. That is, you'd be operating on the presumption of guilt rather than the presumption of innocence, which may be the right thing. I don't know. Sorry.
Chris, I know you had a finger on that. I've got you at the bottom of the list for speakers, so you'll have a word and you'll have your say in a moment. The gentleman next to Shlomit.
Thank you. We've been talking about an epistemic problem here. And people have been using the word facts as though that defined the problem, but it isn't. It's as much a matter of probabilities. Donald Rumsfeld took a lot of stick for the business about no-no-no-no's and unknown-no-no's, but I mean, I think it's actually a very accurate assessment of the decision-making environment in which people work. Given that that's the case, the next question that raises is, in a rights-respecting democracy, why should a body, whether judicial or quasi-judicial, what you want to talk about and how you want to describe it, be given the last word on this rather than the democratically chosen vehicles? And someone, I think it was Cheney, made the point that we need to go back to the Republican notion of responsible and accountable government, which in this context specifically means removing the elements of secrecy. I mean, what we need is exactly, we talked about deference to the legislature, to Parliament. It isn't, it's actually deference to the executive. And executive hides the stuff from Parliament or from Congress. And what we need, I think, are mechanisms to ensure that the debate is open to the soldier, to the citizen, on the basis of not only the full information in terms of facts, but what are the factors borne in mind by the decision maker. Where actually, I think, to get the kind of responses you want, it would be much more fruitful to look at domestic institutions and republicanize them, rather than look to international law and this rather, I think, wholly plausible notion of getting states to agree to something at a much different and more moved level.
Okay, I agree with you that the idea of getting states to agree is probably implausible. But I don't agree with you that democratic deliberation within a large body of people is a very good way of arriving at the understanding of any moral issue. No matter how long you carry out debates about some complicated and difficult moral issue in a democratic country, you're going to be dealing with large numbers of people with rather little understanding of things, full of kind of prejudices and so on. And if you're looking to kind of majoritarian decisions, I find that a really unpromising way of arriving at something approximating moral truth.
Thank you. We've got three more questioners, Uwe, Andrew, and Chris. 5 minutes left, so.
Yeah, I think maybe the court should make three different possible determinations. First, it could say there is no war to be fought whatsoever. Second, it could say this war that you are fighting is completely all right, but what is important for me is the third possibility that they say, well, this war that is currently being fought is unjust because Vietnam is not only trying to save the Cambodians, but also to get the garbage dump at the Vietnamese border, and that is an unjust goal. So strictly speaking, that is an unjustified war. But if soldiers would not participate in that war, the alternative would be that 1 million Cambodians would die. So we, the court, say that this is an unjust war, and we will hold the state leaders accountable for their unjust aims. However, we will permit the soldiers to participate in the war. In fact, we even endorse their participation.
Yeah, if I can say just quickly, I think that coincides with what I was saying in response to an earlier point about the unit of evaluation not being the war as a whole, but aims or missions or whatever. So what the court could say is the aim of capturing some bit of Cambodian territory is an unjust aim, but the aim of rescuing Cambodians from Pol Pot or something is a just aim, and that can legitimately be pursued.
Thank you. Andrew.
I like your paper, Jack, so I have what I thought of two friendly suggestions. So the paper is about authority, because you anticipate somebody justifying the permissibility of participation in a war by saying the participants were duty bound to do so in virtue of being commanded. So then, it was one of the standard ways of justifying authority is to say that the agent would better conform with reasons that apply to them independently of command by treating the command as authoritative rather than acting on their own judgment. So my first question then was to suggest there were two ways in which you could understand your proposal within this framework. You could be counterposing an alternative authority to the authority of the state. You could be saying that participants have a duty to obey the court rather than their own state in this particular domain. Some people have raised problems with that. For example, the fact that the court won't be able to give immediate decisions. There's another way that you can make the argument which avoids that type of worry, which is just to say that what the court might show is that the participants are better off acting on their own judgment than by by deferring to the court. Supposing it's the case that I look back at my own government's track record and I see that the court has nearly always found against it, or at least my government has a lower than 50% chance of being right about whether it should go to the court. In other words, if the court is reliable, I'd be better off tossing a coin than by following my own government. It looks to me that might have had enough just to undermine the authority of my state and show that I'd be better off acting on my own judgment, or at least tossing a coin. So that might be a way you could respond to some of the worries, just by saying you're trying to undermine the authority of the state over us, rather than create an alternative authority. Second observation I have is that given this is really a paper about political authority, I'm a bit puzzled why in the paper you didn't say a little bit more about what your views of authority are. I'm an instrumentalist about authority, but the problem is, so I think this view, authority is there as our servant to enable us better to conform with the reasons that already apply to us. The problem is, it's very much a minority view. Most philosophers now, or at least a lot of them, are Democrats. They think that there are reasons to accept the authority of the democratic state, even if it's not an effective discovery for us. So I think it would be helpful for you to respond to that kind of position, either say why it's wrong, or why your view is robust in the face of it. You might do that by saying that the authority of democracy has to be limited. There are some decisions of such momentous importance that we need something akin to an institution of judicial review, which is a more effective discovery device than consulting the masses. Right? Because as you said, the masses are not very good at knowing what reasons independently apply to them.
Andrew, I'll have to stop you there. Okay.
You can make some choices.
Andrew, sorry, I have to stop you there. Thank you. Before you reply to that and have a last word, let's just get a word from Chris.
Right, I'll be brief. I'll make two statements that I can argue about afterwards if anybody wants to. The first one is that when David gave his proposal, it sounded a little bit crazy, right? But it isn't. And we're actually looking at things similar to that, or at least something along the lines of what David was talking about, at least as a possible option, or at least a thing to think about. And the second one being that somewhat a counterintuitive way of answering Cheney's problem about going back to the Constitution and the things we already have, and answer Jeff's question is, Bob and I have proposed at one point that a properly construed professional army in a liberal democracy would be a check on power, right? Provide a check on power when the executive branch sort of overruns its constitutional authority. And we did not get put in shackles and run off. So it's at least an option or a way of thinking. So I can argue about those.
Great. I'd like to hear more about your proposal and more about David's. I don't think I have anything much to say by way of wrapping up. I would want to pursue both of the aims that you're suggesting, that is both undermining people's confidence in the authority of the pronouncements of their own state, but also trying to provide them with an alternative, more reliable source of guidance. So I don't think it's either or. And in fact, as you imply, I think counterposing an alternative authority in itself does something to undermine the authority of the state if there's kind of persistent disagreement. And I thank you also for just calling my attention to the fact that I probably should say more about the nature of authority. It will please you to know that although I haven't thought about this very deeply, all of my instincts are instrumentalist about authority, so I think I'm in agreement with you there. I'm a little distressed to learn that this is a minority position. But it's my position. Yeah.
Great, thank you, Jeff. Victor just wanted a quick last word as well.
Just to bolster Andrew's thought about democracy, you might be concessionary to the democracy people. And just say, even if it's true that democracy is important for authority in domestic matters, when it comes to matters where the rights are engaged across states, then we should be less confident about the legitimacy of democratic decision-making, because the interests of the people who are most affected in a war from the other country aren't going to be engaged in the decision-making process. So you need not say, look, I'm an instrumentalist. You can say, I'm being neutral about whether I'm an instrumentalist or not about national democracy and authority. But internationally, this isn't a runner.
Good. I agree with that, too.
Good.
Thanks for all this very helpful discussion.
Thanks very much for speaking.